get to university at 18, 19, and you do have the dream of being a soloist. That is, for a lot of people, the case. And then slowly you get more and more realistic over the years.
Is the orchestra puff still sexy in your age?
Where there can easily be 300 to 500 applications for one position.
I think the fame does... wanting the fame does drive us more than we like to admit.
We also started our account because we see that the whole industry is only holding on to old values.
Advertising yourself is not, it's still a little bit stigmatized.
You can only, let's say, escape competition through authenticity. If you like the podcast, please consider following on YouTube, following on Spotify. That obviously helps us develop the format further and invite exciting guests. Giorgio Constantin, it's great having you on the program. Thanks for being here. You're basically two artists who do satirical videos on Instagram and TikTok, and you, are on a decent trajectory. So congrats on that. You're quite successful in that regard. Today, obviously, for me, it's very curious to talk with you because you're very young, and I guess that is very important for the format to also get your perspective on current trends of the market. But maybe we start with a different question. How did you guys actually meet?
So, the thing is, today we are working together as a clarinet piano and singer piano duo, but that's not always been the case. So we've started our work around 5 years ago. And how we initially met was we were both in the pre-college program of the Hochschule here in Munich. And Giorgio was back then living here in Munich, and I also. And then actually I was looking for a duo partner for the youth competition in Germany, Jugendmusiziert.
And I also took part there.
Yes, wonderful. Yeah. And I was looking for a pianist because it was clarinet and piano duo, and I was asking around a bit, and my professor then connected me to his professor, or to the assistant of his professor, and yeah, that's how we met. Then we started work initially only for the competition, but it worked really well. We really, like from the start off, had a really good chemistry in playing together. And then we thought it would be nice to continue our work together. Then we joined in Munich the Live Music Now Yehudi Menuhin Foundation. Mm-hmm. And that's how we kept going during the time where we still both went to school. Mm-hmm. Because we got some concerts, a decent amount of concerts. Mm-hmm. It was like always social concerts in hospitals, for example. Elderly care homes, and yeah, I think we did this for 2 or 3 years. Then I started my studies, and Giorgio came 2 years later and started mm-hmm. his studies. And since then, we really started to develop ourselves and our artistic image. Mm. And also, we now finally have the time, or had the time, to work on us not only playing in the clarinet piano constellation, but also in the singer piano, in the Kunstlied mm-hmm. constellation. And so I would say our really, really closely together, we're working since about 2 years now.
Okay. Very interesting. I mean, you know each other, you obviously understand, I guess you have a great relationship. That's, I guess, also how the content creation setup was built for all people who are now wondering. I mean, I would maybe first, before you continue listening to the podcast, I would actually go on Instagram and check out the videos of Duo Starke Agnes, and then you know also maybe the reason why they are here today and what kind of like gives them a little edge in their profile, which I think is quite interesting. What is important for me to say, you're around 20 years old both, right? So you're just starting out in the market, brand new and looking on things. How do you currently perceive the vibe of the classical music industry?
Well, there's kind of two sides to it. There's one that is extremely positive. We know there's more orchestras than ever before. We know more people are listening to classical music than ever before, at least as a number of streams, maybe not percentage of the population, I'm not sure, but it's growing. The fear is in how relevant it is to our generation, especially. And the problem there, I suppose, is the marketing, the communication, that there is really a divide between what previous listeners of classical music, what people that have listened to it, been listening to it for 20, 30 years need, which is just, tonight there's Mozart's Requiem at the Isar Philharmonie, and what people our generation need. So I think our generation needs emotion. It needs a reason to go to the concert, an idea of what the concert is going to be like. Should it be a date night? Should it be something you do with your friends? And that's just kind of completely missing from the language of classical music. It's kind of like, you know, it's a silly example, but if Coca-Cola was selling sugared water instead of, you know, happiness and friendship and hanging out with your friends, it's missing a point of communication with our generation. I think that that's our biggest fear. We've made fun of it, of course, on social media, but also ultimately we want to embrace the need for this to change, to help ourselves, you know, to communicate with our own generation, and eventually to help, you know, venues and organizations to do the same with us.
Mm. Interesting. I mean, if you talk with, let's say, your teachers that come from a different generation, what differences do you feel? Like, how is the market? Can the market from back in the day, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, can it be compared with today's market? And maybe what are the differences?
I would say that the market 20, 30 or even 50 years ago basically was the same as it is today. But today the problems are more visible. The problem is, I just recently played together with a conductor and we also had a little chat about this. He told me that 50, 60 years ago, there was a normal transition when you grew older, when you were like 30, 40 years old, you were making your money, etc. It was natural that you also would grow into stuff like the arts. For example, you would go to a museum, you would maybe go to a concert once and then you'd see, oh, I like it. And let's do that, you know, and let's go there more often. And this transition is not happening anymore. And I would say the market, if you compare the markets from 50 years ago, where that transition was still happening to today, you can really see that the classical music industry is still holding on to old beliefs. And still holding on to that old thing that the audience will come and they will always be older and there will older people, and of course people grow older. We have a very big population on the earth, so there naturally should be more people coming. But that's nothing that's happening anymore. And I think the market of 50 years ago maybe had it a bit easier. Because it was, you could still get really nice images of people, you know. People could position themselves more as like the genius, for example, or as the greatest interpreter of this and this music, etc. Mm. But this is not working anymore in this in the market that you have today.
Mm, interesting. It all sounds very pessimistic. There are also many optimistic, you know, things, and that's also why you choose the profession, right? I always hear all the pessimistic things, and then I ask you, why did you actually choose the profession? So obviously there's some reasoning, which is also beautiful around the market, but I see your point, and obviously these are the thoughts that you have in mind, right? What can we do with it? How can we innovate? We'll touch on that later. Let's move on to the, let's say, sentiment in music universities, right? I mean, obviously... if you don't live behind a stone as a young artist, you see that, let's say, budgets are decreasing, or there's a general, let's say, higher urge for profitability, state funding is decreasing. You hear all of these things and trends, and now you are then learning your instrument or pursuing your career in something. Obviously, in a couple of years, you have to play in that market, right? What is the sentiment in universities? What do you guys talk about? Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm going to give you more pessimism, but well, no, there is a lot of fear. There is a lot of fear for sure. And there's really a dichotomy between either you're one of the very lucky few who get a career, or you have to do one of the other professions, which are, you know, teaching, potentially being a freelancer in some sort of way, but it's not seen as a successful path. It's often, unfortunately, frowned upon. For no good reason, but it is kind of how young people at our universities feel, I would say.
So that's the thing. Like, if you say from the beginning on, I want to become a teacher, it's rather like, not cool. Yeah,
right. Definitely. That is the thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is sad, because, you know, we need teachers. And
passionate teachers.
Yeah. Passionate teachers, yet, in order to keep it alive.
Yeah, obviously, music teachers, especially like, let's say in the very early stage, yeah, are probably the first touch point that many people have in their lives with classical music. If you think, like, if you're 5-6 years old, and not in the professional segment, right, but in, let's say, in like the Zürcher Musikschule in Germany, like, where you go as a young kid, right, that's for many people the first connection with classical music, maybe, that they have.
And that also brings back to the whole issue of education, basic music education in schools, right?
Right.
Because, you know, if we're talking about a concert, again, if I read Mozart's Requiem, if I'm an average 20-year-old, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of event I'm going to. Is there going to be a choir on stage? Is it a solo? I have no idea, mm-hmm. right? And that comes from I think, the basic musication, education, sorry. And I think that is also what's missing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to align to that question. So the typical career paths I see is either you do the solo way, so a freelance career. You do, let's say, a fixed income position, that is either an orchestra, right, or teaching. Is there anything I'm missing out? Any other career paths you see?
There is. I mean, it's a type of freelancer, but with social media, with influencers that do a bit of everything. That is
hybrid, so to speak.
Right, totally hybrid. So they'll have some concerts, but they don't have the stress of having to live off of it. So maybe they'll also teach online. They'll also give just advice on videos and hopefully monetize their platforms at some point. So there is also a hybrid version, but that, you know, that's a very small percentage. And of course, that can't be everyone in the market.
Maybe let's start with the orchestra path, because obviously, I mean, I would say I know the market well, right? But still, also once I prepared for today, I was like figuring out this application process for orchestra positions. And I actually didn't like know a few things before. Maybe Konstantin, because obviously you are now in Wuppertal, right? Wuppertal Orchestra, yeah? Maybe take us along how this application process for orchestras usually works.
Well, I'm currently in the orchestra academy there, which means that I am on a one-year contract, and I get to know the orchestra, I get to know the playing, I get to know the pieces. I'm always on second or third clarinet, for example. And so the process basically is, everyone has heard of the platform MUVAC, Music Vacancies, and where every orchestra can list any open position that they currently have, whether let it be academy position, a time contract, a fixed permanent contract, etc. And the process then is that you apply within the deadline, and then all the applications that came in are being reviewed. And based off of your application, the orchestra will decide whether they want to invite you to an audition or not.
Okay, how many people apply for a position?
It's very difficult to say, because for me it's actually even more difficult, because I am here in Germany and I play the German system clarinet, but there's also the French system clarinet. And basically the German system is only played in Germany and Austria, although there's also a tiny difference between the German and the Austrian clarinet, or the Vienna clarinet, so to say. And then the French system is basically played everywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. So you could say that for an open position in Germany, you maybe get 60 to 80 at maximum, I would say, applications for a clarinet position. Yeah. And that's not much. And then around, let's say, maximum 40 to 45 people, if 50 get invited to the audition. But there's other instruments like flute, where the market is just absolutely overflowing with flutists, you know, and where there can easily be 300 to 500 applications
for
one position, you know. Insane. And in the end, and then, you know, and the steps that come after that is you get invited to the audition. And then usually the first round you play. For my part, it would be the Mozart Concerto, and you only play.
You play it so like online or already
no,
offline?
No, it would be like. In person.
Yeah, like, but sometimes they filter out online as well, right?
Yes, so, sometimes you do have to send in also a playing, like a video of you playing with a fixed repertoire. Mm-hmm. It could be that they want you to play the Mozart Concerto, or it could be that they want you to play orchestra excerpts. Mm-hmm. That's all possible. But then if you get into the live audition, then you get into the first round, you have to play Mozart Concerto, usually is the exposition of it. If they are generous and have time, you're also allowed to play the first 16 bars of the second movement. Mm-hmm. And there you can already see it's like everyone has 3 to 5 minutes at max, where the person really has to concentrate everything on this one point, you know, and everything has to be totally on point. Then,
but they don't see you when you play, right? Is that correct?
It depends. Okay. It depends. I mean,
so there's a curtain, and
for an orchestra academy, they usually see you,
okay.
Because it, I actually don't know why. What's the big difference? But for fixed positions, you're right. It's often that in the first round they have a curtain, and we've also talked about that in our recent.
Yeah, video. I saw it. Yeah. And the reasoning, right, was that the let's say more women were accepted statistically.
That's one of the reasons. But I would say there's another reason, which is that there's also some type of bias. Because it could be that your professor is already playing in the orchestra, for example, and or you're good friends with one person sitting in a jury or with multiple people sitting in a jury, you know, and it's just to eliminate that and that you're really that you really get into the orchestra because you're qualified, you know. Then what happens is when you get admitted to the second round, it could then you usually have to play orchestra excerpts. For us clarinetists, this is mostly Beethoven's Sixth Symphony and Ein Sommernachtstraum by Mendelssohn, maybe Shostakovich Ninth Symphony, etc. There's like for every instrument, there is a book which lists all the orchestra excerpts and like has it like precisely written from bar to bar so and so, and you can. Every musician who wants to get into an orchestra has this book.
You can understand how that's extremely stressful as well for students because they, you know, audition opportunities are limited and they're, as you just heard, extremely competitive, right? So we are surrounded by people that are constantly working towards these auditions. And maybe after months of work, you're kicked out after 2 minutes of playing. You know, it's also psychologically, it's very demoralizing.
It absolutely is. I mean, in my life, I've taken about 10 auditions and...
Already 10.
It was
Is it a lot at your age or like
I would say everyone has its own has its own tempo, you know? Because there's people
I see the interrupt, but I see the point, so you don't have to finish your studies for playing in an orchestra.
You don't have to.
You can just
If you get accepted,
you're in.
Yeah, okay. I won my Orchestra Academy position when I was in my fourth semester of the bachelor studies, you know? So I mean, I would say maybe that's a plus point, you know? Because it really depends on how good you're playing. But then on the other side, as Georgia mentioned, it's such a stressful process. It definitely takes a toll on your psyche, you know.
But once you're in, you have that one probe year test.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, for an orchestra academy, not. But I mean, for example,
let's say fixed position, Berliner Philharmonica.
If you have a fixed position, then it's at Berliner Philharmonica, it's even 2 years.
Okay.
There are some orchestras which actually have 2 years of probation period, and I mean that's just extreme, you know, because for 2 years you really have to there's multiple things to it, you know, because first of all you have to play perfect, you know, there's no room for mistakes, or if you do a mistake then you know it's you know more like this, and then you also have to fit into the orchestra into the whole society of the orchestra, because it's around 100 people playing, and if you make it past the probationary period you have a fixed contract and there's no way that you can get kicked out of the orchestra, except for if you, of course, do something that's illegal, for example, or not, doesn't comply with the orchestra rules, you know? That's something different there. But if it's a probationary period to test you on a artistic level and on a human level, you know? And I would say it's a really, really hard process. And if you make it past that, then you've really, really, really achieved something. It's really, really chapeau to that.
Interesting. Yeah. What do you think about the fact that you then cannot, let's say, get kicked out of the orchestra? I think that is, you know, until you're in, I think it's a very hard process, but obviously it will probably elevate the quality of orchestras, which is great, right? But then once you're in, by human nature, I don't know, you know, if you basically can do, obviously people perform well there and give their best, but if you have in mind that pretty much I could do, you know, anything that I want, a little bit exaggerated, but I will still keep that position, is that healthy for the long-term quality of orchestras?
No, it's not. That's also
a strong opinion. Okay.
Yeah, it is not healthy for the orchestra because the orchestra depends on every single person and on every single player being 100% into what they are doing, you know, and into their position. You know, they really have to give all their heart into it, and if they don't do it, then the whole orchestra quality will suffer from it. You know, and that's a question that you will have to ask yourself early on. And that's a question which also I asked myself. Would I be the one to fill out this position with all my heart? Mm. And or is there something else that I desire, you know, in my artistic vision? I mean, of course, if you get a position in a very big and great orchestra, then there's always room for you to also get a parallel career as a soloist.
I was going
to
say, yeah.
That's totally possible. For example, if you look at Berliner Philharmonica, BR Symphony Orchestra, all the soloists, or not all, but many of them, they all regularly play solo concerts, etc.
Yeah.
But if you get into an orchestra where you really have to show up every week for your services, or let it be every 2 weeks, it depends if you're playing in the symphony orchestra or in an opera orchestra or in an orchestra that does both, you know, then there's less room for you to also pursue a freelancing career, so to say. I mean, what you can do is teach if you want to. But really, a freelancing career parallel to that's absolutely extremely difficult to do.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, a lot of our clients do that. So they are, I don't know, Vienna Philharmonics. So because a couple of people come to my mind, and they kind of like also use that as a platform to elevate their freelance career, right? To get into the position. So the orchestra actually gives them the introduction, this high brand value. Okay, he plays a Vienna Philharmonic, you know, and this is, now they do chamber music, and that's also the reason why they market themselves, right? A little bit besides that, and like broaden their thing with it. But I mean, to follow up on that, why do you have such a strong opinion on this thing that it's probably not a healthy thing to have lifetime positions? Have you made a couple of experiences and talked with orchestra people?
There was a misunderstanding. I'm totally for it that there are life positions.
Right.
That's really, really important for musicians, because the musicians who want to play in an orchestra, they need the safety.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's, I know some examples of orchestras in Germany which kick you out after you've reached the age of 35. For example, you know, and that's just insane, because you're in your best shape in your 20s, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
This is when you win your orchestra position.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, because you're human and your body won't be able to work on the exact same level at 50 or 55 or 60, it's just natural that your level will decrease a tiny bit, a tiny bit at least. And I think it's insane that you get kicked out just because of your age. It's some kind of age discrimination, so to say. And so I would say it's totally important that there is this kind of safety for the musicians who want to play in an orchestra. What I was saying, I think it's not healthy if the person who gets the permanent position is not 100% committed to it, and also has their wants to do their things on the side, etc.
I see. So when they fake a little bit during Probejahr and so on, and as soon as they use, kind of like see what they, I see. I mean, to comment on that, to be honest, I think, what can I say about orchestras, right? Really nothing. So I'm coming from a totally different world, but my perspective on things is always, if you have too much security, it will eventually decrease your performance. If you have too much safety, because if you look at other industries and so on, right, these things don't exist. And that's maybe also why a lot of people criticize the Beamten in Germany. I don't know, right? It's just maybe a sentiment, right? But obviously, if you're really honest with yourself, if you always have to see how things go and what you can do and how you can innovate and so on and so forth, it will probably be, or will probably have a net higher positive result, so you can criticize that, obviously, however, I mean, the process before is so hard that one can argue, okay, once you've gone through such a hard process with such high competition, you really deserve to have that seat, and that's, you earned it, right? So I totally see that perspective as well. Is the orchestra path still sexy in your age?
I mean, I think it's still I don't know if it's attractive, like the lifestyle is necessarily attractive, but it does still show status and achievement, and it's highly respected.
How much can you earn in an orchestra?
Oh, that range is very, you can't.
Do really, you have a range?
You can't really say.
Brutto Jahresgehalt in Euro?
You really can't say, because there's also differences in the orchestras. For example, in Germany, you have the type A, B, C orchestra, and it really, really depends on which orchestra you are. And the thing is, of course, every solo position earns the same, and every tutti position earns the same in the orchestra.
So all people that are playing earn the same money?
Yeah, I mean, every solo position, because solo oboe, solo flute, yeah, solo clarinet, they earn the same, mm-hmm. and they earn more than a tutti player.
They earn more than a tutti player.
Yeah, yeah.
How much,
yeah.
like, how much percent more roughly?
I really it's so dependent on the orchestra. You really, mm-hmm. you really can't say it. It's
but are there orchestras to ask you, Frank, where you can start already with 100,000 plus a year, brutto?
I would say 100,000. That is something that you can only achieve in, and I'm really not sure about this, but mm-hmm. that you can really only achieve with the top tier A orchestras. Mm-hmm.
So like Vienna Philharmonic, BRSO,
Berlin Philharmonic,
Berlin Philharmonics.
Yeah, yeah. That's more something like this. But 100,000 is already really put very high. Okay. I'm also not so familiar with the mm-hmm. with the orchestra salaries. I just mm-hmm. know that there's different types of orchestras, which are like the type of orchestra also implies the salary that you get. There are some kind of Tarifverträge that are like specifically closed mm-hmm. between, for example, the city and the orchestra or the state and the orchestra, depending who funds you. You know, mm-hmm. so it's you. There is absolutely no range that I could give you because it's so different. In Munich we have 7 orchestras, and I can tell you there is like at least 20 different salaries that will be paid, so yeah.
But it's interesting about this thing with the security of the career as well, mm-hmm. because I also have the feeling that it's completely different from other industries. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, business industry, the tech sector especially, it's like grow or you die. You know, you have to innovate constantly. Mm. And we just don't have any of that in music. And I think because of these systems, the way it works is always, if you play well, you will eventually achieve something. You're never asked to do something new. You're never asked to do something original. You know, even just to get into a music school, they ask you to play an audition. You play for a few minutes. You're not asked to engage with an audience. You're not asked to write an appealing concert program. So I do think we are missing that also in our careers.
I think very true.
It would be healthy to have a bit of Absolutely. That.
Like, that's a very spontaneous reaction, but I can very much relate to that because I think, right, you're always asked to play well, like in the whole thing, right? And nothing else, right? And that is maybe what is like missing in the market, right? Yeah, very interesting. I mean, on the other side, I mean, last week I had a podcast is coming online tomorrow. Professor Dr. Stefan Frucht, who is the director of Siemen Arts Program, he's probably, I mean, his network is insane, right? And he probably knows everyone in Germany from the economic sector and tries to interconnect with the cultural sector. He makes it possible that really like hundreds of millions a year fly into the cultural sector because of his position. And he was a big fan of the current university system. And he said that if you study music, he studied music and medicine, and he learned way more for his life in his music studies than in his medicine studies, for example, he said, right? But it always comes obviously down to the natural talent that you apply to things, right? In combination with that, I think, yeah. But let's come back to the career path. So we've now discussed the fixed thing, the orchestra thing, and so on. I still like have the feeling that most artists want to have a solo career. I think, but there's this like super high competition. Are people aware of it, or are there still, let's say, a lot of young people that really want to pursue this freelance career?
I think people are extremely aware of it. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, first of all, I think the kind of stereotypical path is you get to university at 18, 19, mm-hmm. and you do have the dream of being a soloist. That is, for a lot of people, the case. And then slowly you get more and more realistic over the years, I think, and you start right. considering maybe teaching, maybe orchestra. For some instruments, of course, it's straight to the orchestra, no matter what, kind of, but that's kind of the feeling. I don't know. How do you see it?
Yeah, it depends actually on the instrument, is what I would say. Because for us woodwind players, there is not really musicians who really have a solo career. There's maybe like a few examples. Mm. And that's why for us as woodwind players, it's usually I will go into an orchestra, and then maybe I'll have some solo concerts from time to time. That's the first part that you would think of. Same goes for brass, especially for brass players, because, I mean, mm-hmm. there's not many solo concerts that you can play as a brass player. There's like even less solo concerts than you have as right. a woodwind player, you know. But I would say that for the strings, it's something completely different, because you have many examples. of a freelance, of soloists who play violin, cello, etc. A double bass, not necessarily, but viola also. And they have all these role models, and that's why it at first may seem realistic to pursue a solo career if you play these kinds of instrument.
Yeah, but that's the thing as well, actually. You can get very hopeful, but then, the reality is that there's kind of a like economics of superstars thing going on, which is that the top tiny percentage kind of earns all the money and gets all the engagement, the concert engagements. Mm-hmm. Because if a soloist can sell out a hall, they will be reinvited next year, possibly for the rest of their lives, you know?
Right. And then the slot in the program of this hall is already filled, right? So, and they have,
So that's kind of the issue. And I don't know how aware people in universities are of that. On top of that, there's a big difference between the success we see from outside, for example, through social media, and the kind of actual stability and monetary success that's behind that. Unfortunately, it's more and more common for young musicians, especially, to be able to maybe tour Europe as a group, as a trio, or as a duo for a season. And that might look like a lot of success from the outside, but the reality is they're often playing for exposure, for maybe the cost of the hotel room, or you know, a small fee. And also with our interview series that we've started, we don't feel that any of people our age that are, so to speak, successful in that regard, that they have a full concert calendar, feel secure about their career at mm-hmm. all. They are very scared, even in that position. And from the outside, those would be the successful ones, right? Mm-hmm. So it's
a bit interesting. Interesting. I mean, I want to find out what is the vision of this younger generation, right? And what relates with young people. What do you think is most important for artists? Is it the monetary aspect? Is it safety? That you have freedom to play the repertoire you want? What do artists value most in your age?
You go.
Hard question. Yeah, so the thing is, I would say it's a question of your own personality at first, because there's people who really value security and who really just want to have a nice life and do their music and just always be in the position to you know, play, etc., you know. And then there's the people who want to get exposure and want to be in front of the orchestra, for example, you know, mm-hmm. and be the soloist.
So fame a little bit.
A bit of fame also plays into it, of course. So it really is, it comes down to what kind of person you are. And that is what shapes you as a musician and shapes you, like your vision that you have. Yeah.
Mm. What do you think?
I think it's, I don't know. It's, I think the fame does, wanting the fame does drive us more than we like to admit, especially because in classical music, the idea is that we're focusing on the composers and on the music. And I think that's just not true also for the audience, because they go there for the soloists, you know, that has a big, big effect on how much a concert will sell. So that I think that is part of it. On the other hand, I do agree that there's people that think, you know, as long as I can play the music that I've been working all my life to learn, if I can perform it, whether it's in an orchestra or in a chamber music group or alone, I'm happy. And the economic side can be anything, as long as I can live off of it. Yeah. There's a lot of people that just humbly want to be able to do their art. I think that's also there.
Right. What is your goal?
Well,
interesting question.
As a duo, we have, the main goals are through social media to expand the classical music community and audience.
Right.
We want to break down all things classical music, theme from simple to complex themes, make them understandable for anyone. As musicians, that's also reflected in how we do our concerts, with our concert programs and involving the audience, engaging the audience, and just making it easier to access. Mm. And then as individuals, we have, of course, our differences. I myself am really interested in the social media and marketing sector, so mm-hmm. I do a bit of consulting for that. Konstantin, you have another story there.
Yeah, I mean, for my part, for the last 3 years, I would say I've been working to get into an orchestra because I thought this might be this would be my path. But actually, it's very interesting because I already knew that I wouldn't stay in an orchestra for my entire life until I get retired. And I always pushed that a bit away, and was also for our work together, this was some tough time, I would say, that we encountered, you know. But then, like, after, it was also a kind of a process, you know, of discovering yourself as a musician. Right. And at some point, I just realized, I really want to shape the music that I do. And I really want to have some say in what I am doing, you know. And that's the compromise that you have to do when you are in the orchestra. You have your stability, but you also have to do what's done, you know.
Yeah, you have to fit in.
You have to fit in, and you have to follow the conductor in the end, you know. And so I mean. You know, we also started our account because we see that the whole industry is only holding on to old values. And then you see, like, I don't know, a big soloist is coming to an orchestra and playing the XY concerto, you know? And then there's the video where he's like, hello, I'm this and this guy, and I'm so honored to be playing this and this concert there and there, and I would love to see you all, you know? And, you know,
we've all seen these videos.
We've all seen these videos. We have made fun of it in a way.
It's just a shame. I mean, at the end of the day, I just think we're playing some of the most beautiful music ever written.
Yeah.
Let's please have the communication match that.
Absolutely. You know,
sometimes they're asked to do that by organizers.
They are, you know, but I really just noticed that I have much more like fun and have more passion when I can really shape it myself, or when we can together create a program and create. I mean, I would say my credo, or also for us as a duo, is that we want to give the audience an experience, and we want to really take them with us on the musical journey and take them through the whole concert. And we don't want people sleeping in our concert. I mean, if they have to, okay, but you know, everyone's free to do what they want to, you know. But that's just something when you go into the freelance path, which is what I've now decided to do, then you just have much more freedom there. And for my part, it's, I mean, I do three things. I do clarinet, I do singing, and I also do conducting. And I could really imagine myself, just as Georgia will go a bit on the marketing side, I will probably try to get a bit on the conducting side also. Right.
Obviously, you know, emphasizing you're young, this can always change, right? And you're trying out a lot of things. But what I hear is, if I had to answer your question now from what you said, is you want to have, let's say, entrepreneurial freedom, right? So you want to try out a lot of things. But this always points more into the freelance side of things, right? And let's see how this goes.
And I really want to emphasize that it's absolutely honorable if you want to pursue an orchestra career. Also, it's really important that we have orchestra musicians, you know. I think that's what's not stressed enough in the whole industry, is that every path, that there is no correct right path. There's always the illusion, you know. Yeah. You know, yeah. But it just is not there, you know. And I would love to that everyone gets more aware that every path that you go with your music, as long as you're happy, is the right path. Because if you do music, but in a setting where you're not happy, then what are you doing, you know? Because because you have to put passion and joy and love into the music, and you also have to be in the right setting for it. And every person's shaped different. So for every person, this will be a different constellation.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, to close up this topic, I mean, the big problem I see is just this high competition. You know, we have people from all over the world coming to the European classical music infrastructure, because here are a lot of halls, here are a lot of orchestras, right? Also, in our last episode, the guest said that all the funding that in Germany orchestras receive in total, right, is what the whole rest of the world receives, right? So I don't know if that's true. I didn't double check, but if it is, right, you can clearly see why so many people, let's say, come here. And this obviously leads that there's so much competition in the market and so much pressure, and maybe also the Hochschulsystem sets sometimes wrong incentives. I don't know, why do they just don't limit the capacity of people who study? Why is there not
a stronger burden
at the beginning? I don't know, right? But we'll see what it brings. I still have the feeling that there's a lot of, let's say, middle field in the classical music market. So it can get super worse, right? Once you're in, you can still have a teaching position, you do that, or you teach at music training. So you kind of find a way, you know, to figure out your economic life as well. I have the feeling that in other markets, let's say, take the hip-hop industry or the pop industry, this Schere, right? So the burden is quite higher. So they're like these superstars, right? These super, super, superstars cannot be compared to classical music, yeah, in terms of the monetary aspect. And then like the middle field and the especially lower middle field don't have any, you know, chance to play and so on. And because of this whole infrastructure with concert halls, with theaters and so on and so forth, a lot of people get infrastructure, right? And get more, let's say, a more profound economic perspective on things. Right.
I sometimes think that, you know, we're very good at telling the story that it's hard for classical musicians.
Yeah.
And it absolutely is, but I don't think pop musicians have it any easier. And I think that's important to remember. At the end of the day, because it's a little bit more, you know, institutionalized in classical music, there's usually a venue with funding behind it. We, for example, are never going to be asked to play for a beer at a bar, you know, that which every pop artist has to do. Mm-hmm. So there is a bright side to that as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Also, I mean that let's say crossover thing, you know, crossover phenomenon in the classical music market, I guess, is heavily judged, you know, by the market, right? So people laugh at that. However, maybe I can also sometimes also understand why people choose to do that, because you can just like drastically increase your audience. You have, in the monetary way, it remembers me of these violin players that play at these après-ski parties, right? They have, I don't know, 300,000 followers on Instagram, and I think, you know, when I'm at these après-ski parties, right, I think, okay, you know, if classical musicians would be there, they would judge her, right, and judge her on that path. But there are pros and cons on these things, obviously. What is this crossover sentiment look like in?
I mean, we love it. We're big fans of it. We've done a video where we tried to also remind people that classical music is kind of everywhere, especially recently. We've had some major, major pop artists use orchestras, like the London Symphony Orchestra is doing all kinds of things with Ray, with Rosalía, with this Icelandic singer Leve, who's playing a cello solo in the middle of her show. We really like to embrace that. And more, you know, directly in the classical music market, there's Abel Salauchwe, this South African cellist, mm-hmm. who's done albums and mixed music from tribal music from South Africa that he learned as a kid.
Ah, but it's Selavuchi,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And he'll play a Bach suite as well in the middle of the concert. And it just works. I mean, it attracts a bigger audience. People love it. And I think we really want to embrace that. We want that to be reflected in our own future recordings. And it's already reflected in our concerts. Hmm. We always bring a bit of jazz, for example. So I'm a big fan.
I mean, at some point, if you don't earn money with the thing you do, maybe it's time to pivot, right? And just, I don't know, I would step away from my ego in that regard. But yeah, just an opinion. I mean, essentially, I always think, especially what you are now doing with social media, trying to build a platform is actually something quite useful, because obviously you need to be seen, right, in order to be heard. And you can only, let's say, escape competition through authenticity. I mean, no one can compete with you being you, right? So if you express yourself on social media in, let's say, your way, right, and position the topics you want to talk about and so on and so forth, this gives you visibility, but this gives you also, just authenticity, and people want to work with you. And this is also why we're here now, why I talk with you in the podcast. There are probably, let's say, hundreds of other musicians who have the same opinions and might be even better podcast guests than you, but you don't know them, right? And I guess this visibility aspect is a big thing. And we also had the German gents in the show, right? And it's pretty much the same, right? So they built visibility and now they're heard, right? And I guess it's very important to emphasize that. Yeah.
So it's about putting yourself in a category of one. That's super important. And also appreciating that if you put your views out there and you put your authentic self as a musician out there, people with similar views will align and they will reach out.
Mm.
And that's something we're just starting to learn, that just putting something out there is so powerful. So,
mm-hmm. 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 I mean, in your videos, you talk a little bit about, let's say, the unwritten rules of the classical music market and you make fun of it. Maybe what are some of these, let's say, unwritten rules from the market that maybe people from the outside perspectives don't see? Do you have some funny examples?
Yeah, so I think it's a pretty universal thing to know that if you have a good network, that will help your career. But in classical music, that is so strong. Everybody talks about how if you don't have the right connections, know the right people, you're never going to make it. And it's this kind of obscure thing everybody likes to say, but I don't know how many people really know what they're saying in that regard. And it's definitely true. Any success story that you hear when you dig deeper, it's not just, you know, being discovered, you know, oh, I saw one video of you, or I saw you at a concert and I decided to hand you a career. That doesn't happen. It's always because the network is already in place. You know, the kind of right people. And what that means for us, essentially, that we've learned is it's very powerful to just look at the people you already know. If you're at a music university, that's not difficult. You're already surrounded by musicians, especially your professors, and see how they can help you, right? So I'm sure there's a professor that has a concert season. So why don't I say, you know, we have this idea. Can we maybe fit into your next concert season? So that's one of the unwritten rules for sure, connections.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Constantine?
Yeah, I think what George said, you know, it's very important, the network, mm-hmm. and that you just put yourself out there. And I think especially what I was able to learn through our work together is that you just have to start.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, at some point you have to start. I mean, so we've been doing these videos now for just about over a year. And before that, we were like, we're looking, okay, yeah, we don't get concerts. I don't know, but we really want to because we really have the passion for our concept, you know, mm-hmm. and we really wanted to put ourselves out there. And then we were looking for solutions, you know, and then we're thinking, okay, yeah, maybe we should do Instagram, but I don't know. And especially for me as a person who first wanted to go into an orchestra, it's dangerous, you know, because there's always going to be people who don't like what you do. Mm-hmm. And if you're really unlucky, there's some very influential person in your orchestra where you join which doesn't like what you do, you know.
And that's another thing, an unwritten rule would be that advertising yourself is not, it's still a little bit stigmatized.
Yeah, right.
That's a big
100%,
one.
100%, yeah.
Which from the outset is like, what? I mean, you want to play, right? You want to have concerts, right? So why not? But from inside, it's like, no, it's pure art, you know, you just do your work, you know, work quietly in your practice room and one day things will come. That's massive and that's really problematic.
Yeah, and that's a thing that's been going on in this industry for decades. That people think they just have to like lock themselves into the practice room and the manager will call at some point, but only when you're good enough, you know.
Yeah.
Mm. That's a very big misconception.
Wait, you have to advertise yourself? Really?
When you're
ready. Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
Okay. No, totally. I can totally relate. I mean, overthinking is happening there. On the other hand, I mean, once you express yourself, right, at the start of something, everyone looks silly, right? And you just have to, I guess, endure, look silly long enough that eventually you will be cool, right? And I guess at some point you now reach that point, rather sooner or later, or maybe never. That's also the risk of it. You can see it in your profile quite well. I mean, to really double down on that, I mean, you're two young students. You have now, I don't know, 12K followers. You get a nice, which is like little, right? But you get obviously like a nice network already from that, you know. That's the thing that I want to say is if you make a little step and if you're a little bit innovative, there are examples like you who do that, right? And I guess that is very healthy for the market because I also know a lot of young musicians and I guess overthinking is what they maybe do best, right? Which is, yeah, they should rather do retard maxing, right? Retard maxing. That's what we currently say. It's fairly weird, but yeah.
No, and we've seen that arc already in our lives, you know, in our lives, I mean, in our last 1 year of social media so much. I mean, when we started, you had friends, you had, you know, professors, doubting what we were doing a little bit, and now we're much more confident and we're like, hey, you know, we just got invited for a podcast and, you know, whatever.
That's the thing. But I mean, you're on Business of Plastic. Wow.
Yeah, you know, exactly. We made it. Yeah, you know, and it's also, it's so nice to see after that year that now people are starting also to approach us, like at music school, for example, and say, hey, I really like what you're doing, you know, and it's really, really nice to see because especially as George said, in our beginning phase, we really had some.
We really had to power through a little bit to decide this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, totally. I see. I mean, to round that up, what are the next steps? I mean, the whole reasoning behind the social media channel is maybe now going a little bit into more serious content. So you started with a lot of satirical content first, and now you also talked about audience development in particular. What are your plans?
Yeah, so as we said, a bit of broadening the audience for classical music. Mm-hmm. And the reason we've switched the tone a little bit recently, as we were saying before we got on the mic, it's that we know we're young, we know we're not experts, but we are in a position where we can do the research and inform ourselves to talk about these themes. So whether it's a misconception about classical music, like the orchestra editions, how do they work? I don't think anybody, average person on the street, knows how that works, right? And it's fun to talk about. Or how do classical musician careers work, composers, history, you know, we're going to delve into all kinds of things in the future. But we keep the comedic content there to remember that, you know, it's not so serious, we're having fun. And also one thing that's really missing for us young musicians, that it's cool to be a classical musician, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not this thing just for old people. We are proud of what we do, and we're excited to put our music on display, and we're excited about what this industry can develop into, you know, throughout the course of our lives. So it's to keep it positive as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything to add, Konstantin?
I think what we also want to do in the future is to put our playing more out there also on the social media.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, it's still something, like, it's unique what we do. Like the clarinet piano and tenor piano duo.
Mm-hmm.
As far as we're concerned,
it's not just the technicality of being both clarinet and tenor. Yeah. It's just how we do the program.
How we do it. And
so you not only play, but also sing then in the concert.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's it.
Ah, crazy.
That's
okay.
It. And that's also what...
That's very uncommon. Yeah, it is.
And we think we should show it more on the mm-hmm. page, you know. And because in the end, that's also what we want to do. We want mm-hmm. to have people in our concert, and through social media, we have the chance to give them a little sneak peek mm-hmm. of what they can expect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but of course, what's also very important to mention is that a video of us playing does not reflect at all what the whole concert experience will be. That's a different different topic. Yeah,
mm. yeah, that's coming in the future.
I mean, from my perspective. Usually in your seats are, let's say, concert organizers, you know, directors. That's like the format is really built on that topic, right? To talk with the business side of the market. And if I had to summarize their opinions and their sentiment, right, I would say the more you can understand their perspective, the healthier the relationship with an organizer will be, right? Obviously, you have your artistic vision, you have your program, and so on. But the more nerdy that gets, the more insecurity is on the other side, right? In order, do they sell their tickets and so on? And what ways are there to bridge that gap, right? I guess if you actively communicate that with organizers, that's what they actually love to see, right? And sometimes I have the feeling that a lot of artists... You can discuss that, obviously. You can have a very different opinion on that. But I have the feeling that a lot of artists don't align their artistic vision with the market reality. And then you can argue, okay, does that make the quality of classical music worse and so on? Obviously, big topic of discussion. But I think if you want to achieve long-term successful relationships with other people, there has to be an overlap, right? And you have to find that overlap. And I guess that's what I also see in our podcast Vorgespräch that we did and so on and so forth. You're actively thinking about that, right? So you're actively thinking about, okay, now you do a little bit more nerdy stuff, but now you build a platform, right? And maybe this, you know, then bridges the gap and so on, yeah?
Right, you're right on the money there. First of all, what we've learned that is not necessarily something we learn in school is that these connections, networking, whatever that we talk about is not transactional. You are never going to go to someone and say, give me a concert, and they're going to give you a concert. That's never going to happen.
Right.
It's about building a relationship and understanding, as you're saying, what the artistic director actually wants and needs. So it's really about forcing yourself as a musician to think about what can I offer for them, the organizer, because then you can actually build a strong relationship on that when they see that you want to help them as well. And the other thing is it's crucial for us to stress Exactly, that it's not just this nerdy thing that we're doing clarinet and singing in one concert, because that doesn't say anything to most people.
Right.
It's about, what is the concert actually like? Well, let us tell you, you know, what actually happens is we do a lot of short pieces, so you're not sitting there through a 40-minute symphony. We do talking in between, right? We tell you about what we're about to play. We tell you a little funny anecdote. We do a little skit, sometimes even a comedic skit in the middle of the concert. Or we break down the barriers of audience and performers. So you don't just sit there quietly. At our last concert, we, in a kind of jazz-influenced piece, what we did was we told the audience, look, take a break, you know, have a drink, chat to the person next to you, talk, and we're going to play this as if we were in a bar. Just relax for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And they loved that. And you know, what happened as well was before that little experiment, they were just listening there quietly, very respectfully. What happened after was, if we made a joke, they would answer, you know? And suddenly you have this relationship with the audience, and that's what we value so much.
Mm.
What we need to work on and what we're very passionate about is explaining this and showing this clearly with evidence as well to artistic directors. So that is a responsibility that we have as artists. I wouldn't say there's anybody to blame. It's not the music institution's fault or anybody, but people our age, young artists, do need to force themselves to think, what can I offer an artistic director?
Mm. Mm. I also like this unpredictability phenomenon. I also saw it in one of your videos, right? And I was actually quite like, I was like, yeah, they're right, right? In every other concert, if you go to big pop concerts, I don't know, you don't know what the artist will play. In classical music, you have the repertoire written down. The problem in classical music is, for most people, that they don't know the repertoire. They don't know what to expect, right? Which is even which is also, I guess, very true. But
or they go because of the repertoire. So if it's right. Beethoven 9th, that will always sell out. Right. So that's a crucial selling point for the
totally.
For the organizer. So totally. It, yeah, there's a conflict there.
Yeah, but I see the point that, and this is also, I guess, the point that you were making in that video, is that if you don't know what to expect, this is also a big argument why people go to a concert, because they don't know what to expect, right? They want to be surprised, right?
Right. Yeah. It's once you're aware of the format, I would say. So at a pop concert, you go, you know roughly what it's going to be like your seat, or you're going to be standing, or you can have a drink or not, like the actual functioning of the concert experience. You don't know what's going to be on stage. So we could bring that a bit to classical music, but at the same time, we need to recognize that there's an opposite problem, which is that young people don't know what going to a classical music concert is like. They don't know the duration. They don't know about all these rules about clapping. Do I dress up? Do I not?
Right.
And we're super passionate about that too. There's a video coming about that very soon. And there's unpredictability probably within the music, whereas within the concert experience, it needs to be clarified that it's not a scary experience. And that goes back to the marketing thing that I said earlier. You know, if you're marketing Mozart Requiem, that doesn't say anything to a 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So tell them what the concert experience is going to be like for them, what the evening is going to look like for them.
Mm. Maybe you guys can become program curators, social media influencers, program curators, right? Where I once had that idea. Like, I don't know, you make the summary of the top five most exciting classical music concerts in Hamburg, in Berlin. What's going on this week, right? To give a quick overview, to quickly communicate what to expect, what could be exciting about that, and then you influence the young generation that has that burden. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that it works. I think a lot of, if I mention this name, a lot of people in the sector are going to say, oh, whatever. But if you think about candlelight concerts, okay?
Yeah, that's earning money.
That works so well. And
right.
I mean, my brother, he studies economics, you know, doesn't know anything about classical music. He's been to a candlelight concert. He hasn't been to one of my concerts. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Because what are they selling? The experience. You have this beautiful atmosphere with the candles on stage. You go with your girlfriend or with your friends or whatever, and that sells. And also, so that's one lesson to be learned. And the other thing is the massive difference between what's happening physically. So if I see a candlelight concert poster on the street, it's going to say who's playing and what they're going to play. But if I see it on social media, they're using influencers to say, like, you know, come with me to this candlelight concert. And I mean, that's just exploded. Of course, there's a lot of, you know, funding behind that as well to push those videos. But I think there's something to be learned there, that you can't just take the concert poster and throw it on social media and boost it and expect it to drive interest from people on social media. You know, you need to change the communication as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's leave it at that. I guess it was very interesting to get your, let's say, you know, perspective on the things. I want to build the podcast in a way that we cover all perspectives from the market, right? To really put the business factor ahead and think together how we can optimize it. Thanks for being on.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your work. We love the podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that is actually a remark that I want to make at the end. We had to do this episode in English because both of them were podcast listeners. I was very lucky to see that. And then they asked, and I didn't know that Giorgio, you don't speak German, right?
Yeah, I'm so learning it. So
that is what we do in English episodes. The next episodes will be in German again, hopefully. Okay. Bye-bye.